This is episode 70 of the Fifth Estate podcast. Kevin Williamson in the state, the GOP. All right, it is time for another episode of the Fifth Estate Podcast. I'm Jay Caruso, along with my new co-host from the West Coast, Mrs. Amy Otto. How are you?
I'm doing excellent, Jay. It's nice to be on board.
Yeah, this is going to be great. This is the first time Amy's, you know, she's been on the show before as a guest. Now she's a co-host. So now we have to go into what we usually do, and that is all you listeners, new ones, old ones, everything, we need you to go out there, especially after this first episode with Amy as a co-host. Go out to iTunes, leave us ratings, 5 stars, all that good stuff. Tell us how great it is. We'll love it. She'll love it. And, you know, in that respect, once that happens, once you do that, we'll be in a much better place than the Republican Party is, for certain, right? Right, Amy?
Well, I hope we get more positive reinforcement than last Tuesday.
Yeah, Tuesday was a mess. There's more that's happened even since then in the last couple of days. And so what we decided to do is, you know, we'll bring somebody in who, you know, who is kind of up to date on all this stuff. And according to some, a noted neo-leftist, which I just find absolutely amusing. Kevin Williamson from National Review. Kevin, thanks for being here in the Fifth Estate.
My pleasure. How you doing, Jay?
I am doing well. So again, I think we're all doing a little bit better than the GOP. You wrote something in the wake of what happened on Tuesday. Tuesday was a pretty bad night for the Republican Party. They lost races in New York, and they lost the governorship in New Jersey. They lost the governorship badly in Virginia. Ed Gillespie beaten by about 9 points in his race when, you know, the day before people were thinking maybe he could pull this thing off. And, you know, it was a bad night. And you wrote something called Winning Isn't Winning for National Review. And just kind of give you the header here. It says the American electorate continues to have a low opinion of the president. Then Republicans should calculate that drag into their electoral expectations. So if you want to just kind of talk a little bit about what you kind of wrote in that piece and what you see happening if Trump still sticks around 38%.
Yeah, well, the numbers don't look super good for Republicans. So what happened in the Virginia governor's race is that Gillespie won 9 out of 10 votes of voters who approve of Trump. And he lost 9 out of 10 votes of the voters who disapprove of Trump. And lost that race by 9 points, which was a little bit more than he was expected to. What most people don't know is that Trump's approval numbers in Virginia are slightly higher than they are nationally. I think it's around 44% in Virginia, at least it was going into the election. He's about 37.5% nationally. So if Trump is going to be this inescapable presence who is an issue in every election, and it seems he was, you know, down to things like the mayor's race in St. Petersburg, Florida, and the state legislature races in Georgia, and the ballot initiative in Maine, and all the rest of this stuff. If he is going to be a factor in every race from dog catcher on up through Senate and governors and the House of Representatives, then Republicans should expect to do poorly, relatively, especially in places that were previously sort of on the border. I mean, it's not like they're going to lose Oklahoma or Utah or something like that, probably not least for the near future. But, you know, Virginia used to be a pretty conservative state, and then it was kind of a swing state. And now people are saying, you know, by way of apology, well, gosh, what did you expect? It's a blue state. Well, you know, it hasn't always been a blue state. And there's a reason that Virginia has been moving in a Democratic direction. And that's not just government employment. People tend to try to blame it on that. Well, of course, it's going to be voting Democrat because it's full of government employees and people who like to mooch off the government, so those people tend to be Democratic. It's not really exactly the case. You know, a lot of the people in Virginia who are second-order federal dependents are military contractors and Department of Defense people and things like that, who are not exactly, for the most part, bleeding heart liberal Democrats. So, you know, when the Trump effect is having negative consequences in places like St. Petersburg, which fairly recently had a Republican mayor, Rick Baker, who was a pretty good one, who was a candidate this time around as well, or in places like Georgia, which tends to be pretty conservative and recently pretty Republican, although Georgia hasn't been Republican for a long time, then I think that's something that Republicans need to probably worry about a little bit. And especially in places like Texas, which is not as Republican and not as conservative as people think it is.
And Kevin, to that point, besides, you know, I mean, the metrics on the ground and all these things going into play, how much besides Trump do you think this may also be a reflection of, besides, because I almost look at it as a totality of, if I have to put up a Trump, I might as well get some conservative policy, but then you've also not gotten that as well. So, oh, yeah. You know, people are kind of like, what am I putting up with any of this for? And maybe not turning out. You know, I just wonder, you know, what impact do you think the GOP's performance in not delivering in Congress has had here too?
Yeah, well, certainly I think it's probably an issue. If, you know, Congress was doing great and wonderful things, then Republican stink might not be quite what it is. Although our politics for the last, you know, 30, 40 years has become so centered on the person and the personality of the presidency that that's difficult to sort out, because part of the legislative failure of Republicans in Congress, of course, is related to the president as well. You know, when you talk about the healthcare failure and what looks like it's about to be a similar failure on taxes, you have a situation in which you've got really 3 to 5 Republican factions in the House and about 2 major Republican factions in the Senate, and they don't agree on a lot of big public policy questions, and taxes and healthcare large among those. So you don't have a situation in which Mitch McConnell or Paul Ryan can go to the White House and say, here's what we need to be supporting. We need you to take the lead on this and expect to get some reasonable presidential leadership out of that. You know, if you look at the obvious comparison case, when Barack Obama was elected, he knew that he was elected domestically to do something on healthcare. Granted, it was a bad bill and it's been a bad program, but that's what they wanted to do. He was willing to sacrifice his majorities in Congress to get it done, but he also came up with, you know, the broad outlines of what they wanted their policy architecture to look like, and went out and gave speeches on healthcare for, 104 consecutive days, something like that, pressed a particular piece of legislation with particular kinds of compromises, and it got his party to rally around it and got it done and was willing to expend the political capital to do that. Trump isn't a guy who can do that for a couple of reasons. One, he doesn't understand the policy questions to start with. So, you know, you ask him, you know, Mr. President, what kind of healthcare bill do you want? Well, we should have healthcare that's terrific. Well, great. There's a good answer. But what do you actually want to have in the bill? Well, it should be better and cost less. Well, great. But how do we get there? You know, what sort of actual policy proposals do we want to put in the bill? You're not going to get an answer from him on that. The other thing is that he's a coward. And he doesn't deal well with criticism, especially from the mainstream media. So what you're seeing in the tax situation right now is where the House has produced a bill that was a little bit more robust than the Senate bill was in some ways. And Trump has come out and told the Democrats, well, I think you'll like the Senate bill a little bit better. And you're signaling his support of that, which actually puts off most of the corporate tax cuts that until the day before yesterday were, according to the president, the most important part of the agenda, because they allegedly have a stimulative effect and yada, yada, yada. I don't think either one of those is a pretty good package, is a very good package at all. But, you know, you've got a situation in which the president is not knowing where he wants to be on any of these issues and just going with whatever seems easiest and most popular. But his read on what's most popular is, of course, always a little bit distorted by the fact that all he does is pay attention to the New York City press and watch Fox and Friends.
Yeah, and
well, that's not harsh at all. I don't know. I feel like that was pretty light.
Well, you know, and that's the thing, you know, and everybody looks at Virginia, and you have people who are, you know, the I'll call them the MAGA people, who are saying, oh, this doesn't mean anything. But In 2009, right. You know, it was a similar situation. You know, Chris Christie won in New Jersey. Bob McDonald won big in Virginia. You know, and that kind of laid the groundwork for what we saw happen in 2010. You know, you know, GOP probably could have taken over the Senate in 2010 if they didn't. If there was a couple of better candidates they had run in Nevada and Delaware, for instance.
Man, where do they find those people?
Yeah, now they're Senate candidates in
they look
Alabama.
Glowing compared to Moore right now.
Yeah,
I wouldn't complain. It's only gotten worse.
So I mean,
I was at some conservative thing in Delaware with what was her name? Christine O'Donnell was a candidate, right?
Right.
And man, she was a nutcase. I mean, she was as nutty in person as you expect on television. And but she was. I was talking to her about what she was actually up to because she didn't have anything to look like, you know, gainful employment. And she had this PAC going, and she was telling me about all the work that her PAC was doing, and this and that and the other. As far as I can tell, she was running this political action committee, which existed for no purpose other than to pay her salary.
Yeah. Yeah, the scam PACs became, that became such a big thing after 2010. It's like one of those things that Citizens United was a negative for, is that it became a vehicle for people to create these PACs, these super PACs, where, you know, they didn't actually use any of the money that they got to get candidates elected. You know, the famous PACs that were sent. Yeah, you know, those are the ones that you get the email saying, you know, let's recruit so and so for Speaker of the House. You know, and they the people in question be like, I don't want to be Speaker of the House, but yet here they are.
Yeah.
Send us $50 so we can recruit so and so.
This sounds like a good business.
We should do that. You know, you know. I mean, now that you know, Kevin, now that you're a neo leftist, you know, I just think there's the funniest stuff that I'm seeing on Twitter lately about you and what they're calling National Review. It's like, you could just do that. You could maybe get a whole bunch
Well, yeah. I mean, you really can't pay too much attention to the rage monkeys.
No.
You know, I mean, they're mostly people who don't know anything. So yeah, I get neocon a lot, which is funny because I'm about as close to being neocon as I am to being a leftist, I guess. But yeah, a lot of, you know, anger and stupidity is a bad combination, but it's a common one.
But I mean, going back to what you said about Trump, and this is the thing that I've constantly said too, and I agree with you, is that he doesn't. Yeah, everyone's
that was
like,
my segue from anger and stupidity, by the way, go back to Trump.
But it's the part about, you know, people who sit there and yell at me and say, you know, because I remind people that Trump went around last year and into the election, everything, talking about what a great deal maker he was. And then he says, you know, Mary Catherine Hamm asked him a question about deal making. He's like, with Congress, you have to get everybody in a room and you have to come up with this great deal. He goes, but you have to walk out with the deal that you want. And so I said, you know, if he's not getting this legislation through, so he's about ready to go through an entire year without one piece of significant legislation hitting his desk. And everyone complains that it's Mitch McConnell's fault, and that ignores the history that presidents have of shepherding legislation that they want through the process and to get something to their desk.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, he can complain about McConnell all day, but, you know, McConnell has a job too, and Ryan has a job too, and Congress is full of people who also were elected to office on particular agendas with particular ideas and beliefs. So if Trump doesn't like what they're producing, well, okay, he doesn't have to like it. But if he's got something he would rather them do, you know, a contrary proposal, then let him actually, you know, put it in there and try to get it done. All he does really is just, you know, bitch about Mitch McConnell on Twitter, which is not really the way to get legislation shaped. So, I mean, you've got a problem where you've got some real distance between the House and the Senate, and then you've got disagreement within both chambers. And absent some kind of leadership from, usually it comes from the president. Occasionally you get it from someone else. Like, you know, Newt Gingrich could actually, when he was speaker, at least in the early part of his speakership, he had the juice to put together a compromise on his own. Of course, they had Bill Clinton as a foil, so that made things maybe a little easier for him in terms of getting Republicans to all work together against Clinton. But, you know, Trump is the president of the United States. If he doesn't like what's being proposed in Congress, if he's not happy with it, if he has a bill that he would like to see advanced, I'm sure he could make a couple of phone calls and somebody would, you know, put the bill in for him. It's not like he's going over there with a, you know, a 500-page bill and saying, could you guys pass this? And they go, no, we don't want to talk to you. You know, he's basically sitting on the sidelines and sniping and then wondering why nothing's getting done when he's supposed to be something more like, if not the quarterback, at least the, you know, coach.
Well, I mean, and maybe to pivot away, because, like, obviously it's depressing, I think, to talk about how the GOP is just massively dysfunctional at this point. But in the, to pause and say, if in a tax plan, you know, if there were common principles, and my frustration is, like, you know, all of the things you're talking about, but especially that there's this much division in Congress on something as simple as tax reform, that it's like you would think the one thing the Republicans could pull off, like, blindfolded, would be tax reform. And yet it's still shocking.
Just interrupt you for a second. I don't think it's actually simple. Now, I think the one thing you should expect Republicans to be able to pull off is an irresponsible, unnecessary tax cut that will add to the deficit and be some bad fiscal policy. I think you should be able to expect them to get that done, because that's kind of what they do. But actual tax reform is a lot more complicated than I think most people let on.
Well, I think we're talking. I think we're talking about, you know, even just a tax cut package, because really what they're proposing isn't much reform. I mean, there's a little bit in there, but again, they're not going all the way, and they're already backing off some stuff. You know, one of the things, and I've talked about this, is that tax credits have created just an entire population of special interests that are going to attack that particular credit being rolled back, and we see it with many in the Republican Party on the adoption credit. You know, but you also, there's also, I saw a story, a headline Wired the other day saying the elimination of the electric vehicle tax credit will destroy the electrical vehicle industry. And, you know, it's like, if the entire industry is dependent upon somebody getting a tax incentive to buy one of your cars, well, then maybe it should fail. So that's, you know.
You know, what's funny is that Elon Musk and Tesla for a while have been arguing for getting rid of those subsidies. Because the way this always happens, of course, is you have these tax credits and other subsidies that help businesses come into being, and then they become the dominating firm in the market, and those same incentives help their competition come into being after that. So what they like to do is take advantage of them for their early launch stages and then get rid of them. And we've already reached that stage, I think, with electrical vehicles. You know, the players in that market aren't guys in their garages. It's Honda, Toyota, Tesla, General Motors. Hyundai, I guess, is in there, and Volvo, and a few other companies. So, I don't necessarily get that. But the corporate special interests, of course, are always a pain in the ass. But let's not forget that the middle class is also a very large special interest group.
Yes.
And it's not going to be happy with getting rid of things like mortgage interest deduction or state and local tax deductions. And they're going to throw a fit about it. And a lot of those blue state Republicans are not going to go along with that.
Right. And I think, like, Amy's broader point about the tax bill is that, you know, normally you're right. I mean, I think even what they have here, even if they could just focus on a corporate tax reduction, which, you know, there are a lot of people that, you know, we spoke today to Lawrence Kotlikoff, the economist, who's got an op-ed coming out in the Wall Street Journal where he gets behind the tax cut, and largely because of the corporate reduction that they think is actually going to be the biggest driver of increasing wages and better more so than what they're doing on the personal side, which they didn't even want to really discuss. But you're right about what you're saying.
I'm not even sold that we need a tax cut right now. But that's just me. Go ahead, please.
No, saying and I think that's Amy was trying to draw to get to that point, is that they may wind up not even getting that. And that's
that would be the one valuable thing they could do. I think, to your point, Jay, like, when you start touching all of the deductions, you either have to take all of them away or you're just going to end up in an argument with, like, a billion different special interests.
Yeah, I mean,
Kevin Brady,
Kevin Brady has already kind of indicated they'll offer an amendment that'll keep the adoption tax credit in the plan. And then once you do that, then you're just going to have every other area of that, you know, where they're eliminating, you know, the college industry is going crazy because of some of the credits that the GOP tax plan eliminates, because it's going to cost them. So that's all you're just going to have these lobbying groups, I should say. I wouldn't even call them lobbyists. They're just special interests that are just going to be going after this thing. And you'll wind up with this giant watered down bill that won't really, it'll be like Kevin talked about. It'll wind up just being this a deficit-based tax cut and not really any kind of tax reform. Whether or not that's a win.
Even worse, it might just be a tax increase to a lot of people, which I think is a really fun strategy for them. I look at the bill now and I'm like, the Democrats would love this. Like, you're going to raise taxes on a lot of people and you're going to expand the earned income tax credit or some ideas to do that. I'm like, this is phenomenal. We're going to give people money who don't pay taxes, more of it, and then take more from other people. It's an interesting strategy. And at least from the Republicans' part, I find it fascinating.
Well, and
yeah, strategy might be generous there.
Yeah. Yeah. And
it's sarcastic.
And Kevin, you talked about going back to your piece here, because, you know, going back to the specter of what Trump, what helped launch Trump and what helped him likely get into the White House was populism. And yeah. And so, you know, now, you know, cutting corporate tax rates is not exactly, you know, a mantra of, you know, little guy populism. And I don't think people are really going to much understand it. And you're right. Donald Trump doesn't seem to be the person who can kind of explain it, other than it's great.
Yeah, and it's great. It's great, though, that they're sending Gary Cohn of Goldman Sachs out to explain the general benefits of keeping the estate tax at $11 million. that's some populism for you right there.
Yeah.
You know, populism typically in democratic societies has a pretty short shelf life, because what happens is it's a negative proposition, right? It's nothing works. Everybody's corrupt. The system's messed up. They're all against you. It's the establishment, the insiders, whatever you want to call them. Vote for me, and everything will be radically different quickly, because I'm a businessman. It's often businessmen in the American context, you know, Perot before Trump. And I know how to get things done. I can make deals, whatever it is. And then they show up, and the actual complexities of democratic governance are rather different from what they'd imagined, and they can't really get anything done. And then they quickly become unpopular. So what happens in non-democratic societies is they become authoritarian at that point. That's where you get Venezuela, things like that. What happens in democratic societies is they usually don't last very long. So sometimes you'll see these populist movements in parliamentary countries, and their governments tend to be short-lived for the reasons I just described. In our system, of course, we have scheduled elections rather than called elections, the way we do in parliamentary systems. So he's going to be there, you know, presumably for the whole run. And it's going to be a lot of 4 years of not getting much of anything accomplished. And that's going to lead to all sorts of frustrations. And the thing about Trump is he doesn't really have any particular core values. You know, he's been all over gun control. He's been on both sides of it. Abortion, he's been on both sides of it. You know, he was elected. He gave more speeches about China than he did about anything else other than immigration, I guess, during his campaign. And none of the stuff he talked about is even stuff that's on his radar anymore. You know, tariffs, labeled the currency manipulator, any of that stuff. These were all bad ideas, by the way, but they were what he ran on. He abandoned those the day he got into office, essentially. There's not any serious effort out there to build a wall, much less to make Mexico pay for it, or any of the other things that he talked about. So he can go from thing to thing and from place to place pretty easily, because he doesn't have any core policy principles keeping him in one place. And his need for approval is something that's going to be dangerous for conservatives and Republicans, because eventually he's going to go looking for it from the Democrats, as he already has been a little bit. You know, his flirtation, Chuck and Nancy, as he likes to call them, and his recent comments on the tax packages, trying to make them friendlier to Democrats and all that. In general, I'm fine with making things friendlier to Democrats. I believe in bipartisanship and government by consensus and all that stuff, but that's not what he's actually up to. It's just, you know, favor seeking and approval seeking, which is a different thing from forging a genuine political consensus around a better policy. So I think he's going to be, as his popularity declines, which I think it probably will continue to, and if you see a correction in the stock markets or any other kind of economic trouble, you can expect that to be amplified. He's going to be a real loose cannon, and I think this is going to be a problem, and not just for Republicans, but for the country.
Well, that's the thing that's remarkable when you look at it. We've had two quarters of GDP growth over of 3% or higher. The unemployment rate is like, what, 4%? The stock market is booming. Job growth is good. I mean, even in a month where, you know, we had, you know, storms and everything else, it wasn't that bad. And yet he's still at 37%. You know, president with those numbers.
Let's not get too carried away with those economic numbers, though. You know, we've had a couple of quarters of reasonably good growth at an annualized rate, if that continues. But we had those during the Obama years, too. And, you know, it didn't actually pan out very well. Stock market going up is, you know, a fine thing. But let's not discount the possibility that what we're looking at here really is some asset inflation, which has been going on because of monetary policy and also just terror in other parts of the world economy of people looking for safe places to park things. This is not something that only goes up. You know, we went through this with the housing bubble, and we keep not learning the lesson that prices go up and they go down. And it's a good thing for asset prices to go up, and it's also sometimes a good thing for asset prices to go down. When housing prices go down, it makes it easier for young people and people without a lot of money to buy houses. When share prices go down, it makes it better for people to buy into the market. So the idea of stocks always going up as an indicator of overall economic health or of some kind of broad economic prosperity isn't the case. I mean, it's nice that a lot of households own shares, and that's good. More households should. And in general, a healthy stock market tends to go along with other good positive indicators in the economy. But it's not really quite there yet. And to extent that it is, it's only been a couple of quarters.
And I don't disagree with you on anything that you said. I'm just talking mostly about perception. It's like usually when you have these kinds of numbers, the president is going to benefit from them. And you're right. You're saying if there's he's at 37% with numbers like that. If there is that correction.
And one other thing to think about that is that people's opinions, to the extent that they are shaped by things like economic growth, tend to lag about 6 months.
Yeah.
So if you remember, well, y'all are young, you don't remember George H.W. Bush. You know, he was basically crucified because of a recession that was effectively over by the time of the election.
Yeah, that's true. But
people's opinions take a while to catch up to those things.
All right, so... Let's switch gears here a little bit and touch on well, maybe that's not the right word to use. Shift to the Roy Moore allegations which surfaced today. And you know, the Washington Post story that came out is not just this is not some kind of this is not a tabloid story. This was not one single accuser. This is four different people, two of whom I think two of them were on the record. No, at least one was on the record with this, not anonymous accusers all. And we're seeing, you know, shades of, and Amy kind of brought this up before we got on the thing here, it brought up, you know, shades of Todd Akin in 2012, and we're seeing it already. There are some people saying, "Hey, if this happened, then he needs to go." But there's already a faction of people lining up to say, "Hey, I think this is garbage, and this is a BS story, and it's the establishment Republicans who are planning this, and if Mitch McConnell, he spent $30 million to unseat him, how come he didn't find out about this? It's all conspiracy theory talk." But what do you think about this?
Well, you know, I was a newspaper editor for a long time, and you get a lot of stories in which people are making accusations about public figures, often without a lot of hard evidence, often long after whatever the incident is alleged to have happened, and generally in cases in which you don't really have a good way of finding out. So these are all things to keep in mind. That being said, as a newspaper editor, I would tend to put a lot more credibility on a story in which someone was willing to use their name in public and make these accusations. And certainly if there's more than one party willing to use their name in public and make such accusations, then it becomes, if not necessarily more credible, certainly more reportable, and something that has to be taken more seriously as a set of allegations. Now, if I had four people who were willing to use their names and go on the record and say that they were abducted in a spaceship and they saw Roy Moore there, I wouldn't take that story seriously. But the details of the story don't seem, beyond the realm of possibility. And it's something that's probably going to have to be looked into. You know, I I always want to resist jumping to conclusions about things before you've got sufficient information in to really find out. But there's nothing in these stories that makes me just roll my eyes at them and say, well, this looks like an obvious political hit. I mean, the timing, sure. Obviously, the timing has something to do with the politics, but that doesn't mean that this didn't happen. So, yeah, I'd like to look a little bit more into it. Of course, we've seen people not exactly covering themselves with glory in defending the Republican candidate here. You know, you had Hannity tonight saying, well, she was 14 years old, but it was consensual. And, oh, okay. Hey. Or people saying, well, you know, the age of consent back then was only 12 in Alabama, which, okay, but I'm not sure any of that's going to make me feel any better.
Okay, so let's pause there for a minute. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with more Kevin Williamson after this word from one of our sponsors.
Well, hey there, folks. Neil Dewing with a word from our sponsors at HelloFresh. While anyone can deliver a box of food, HelloFresh opens up an experience that brings the fun of cooking back into our lives. They shop, plan, and deliver step-by-step recipes and ingredients so you can just relax and enjoy all there is to love about cooking and eating. They are constantly experimenting in the kitchen to let fresh, natural ingredients shine. They offer ever-changing menus, classic ingredients in a new light, and easy-to-follow recipes to help you avoid that food coma and feel good inside and out. And it's all for less than $10 a meal. HelloFresh recipes come with step-by-step instructions designed to take around 30 minutes for everyone from novices to seasoned home cooks short on time. They currently offer customers a classic box, a veggie box, and a family box. You can order 3, 4, or 5 different meals per week designed for either 2 or 4 people. And new recipes are created every week. HelloFresh sources the freshest ingredients, measured to the exact quantities needed, so there's no food waste. They employ 2 full-time registered dietitians on staff who review each recipe to help make it nutritionally balanced. And HelloFresh delivers the food to your doorstep in a recyclable, insulated box for free. And now, HelloFresh is offering light summer meals and has just introduced breakfast options. Remember, this is all for less than $10 a meal. Now, I recently got a chance to try a HelloFresh meal, and I had to ask myself, why had I waited so long? The difference in quality was clear. I had the Adobo Loco steak with a poblano corn and crispy potato hash. Was it easy? Yes. Was it fun? Yes. Was it tasty? Also, yes. I was able to follow the instructions without my wife's supervision, and we had a meal that was out of the ordinary. Must recommend it. So, HelloFresh has a special offer to listeners of the Fifth Estate podcast. That's you. For $30 off your first week of HelloFresh, visit HelloFresh.com and enter promo code ESTATE30. One more time, to try HelloFresh and get $30 off your first week, go to HelloFresh.com and use promo code ESTATE30 at checkout.
And we're back. So, Amy, what were you saying about Roy Moore?
I don't know. I mean, to take it a different position, I mean, obviously, I feel like it's an immediately, regardless of stuff, he's probably not politically viable. This is going to stick with him, and the Republican Party needs to be smarter about fielding candidates. I do wonder if these internecine fights we keep having in very red districts make sense, where there was like a compromise candidate, Mo Brooks, in the primary, but, you know, we had to fight so hard about being more estranged, and now we're stuck likely with a candidate who could lose a seat that shouldn't have been losable. Yeah. This is the kind of stuff that's just on both sides frustrating. Like one side, the Bannon type faction, the other side thinking like, I'm going to show them. I'm like, can't we just let primaries maybe play out without having these idiots on both sides probably manipulating the outcome to these terrible places where you end up with really damaged candidates?
Yeah. And I mean, you know, he wasn't a great candidate absent all this stuff. You know, he's kind of a bit of a nutcase to start with. Jonah Goldberg wrote a couple of pretty good pieces on that. His argument was, well, if this year's your red line on this guy, fine. I mean, you got to have one somewhere, but it probably should have been several things before this. So, you know, if Moore ends up being taken out, no great loss, I think, to the Republicans. I don't think he was a very worthwhile standard bearer for their party. I mean, I say this from the outside. I'm not a Republican, so maybe I shouldn't speak too much on what's good for them and what isn't. But he's not the sort of person I'd want to have representing my party, if I had one. And yeah, there's, I mean, the problem, of course, is there's money to be made and power to be had from these ridiculous internecine fights. And this is what keeps talk radio and cable news in business, right? It's the same story over and over and over, that we, the masses, are great and pure and love our country. They, the establishment, are always betraying you and stabbing you in the back and frustrating your hopes and dreams and desires for yourselves and your family and your communities and for our country. And this, you know, constant Shakespearean succession drama, which plays down now to every little race in every little podunk district everywhere. It also has the effect of nationalizing every race. It all becomes, you know, these two big camps within the Republican Party. And so that gets us back to what we were talking about at the beginning, where the president becomes a factor in what otherwise would be local races or congressional district races. The overall partisan position of the Republican Party versus the Democratic Party, the various ideological fights within it, become much more important issues than they otherwise would be if you're running for a House district from, say, West Texas or Southern Oklahoma.
That's, I mean, that's actually, it's an interesting point and a broad thing, because it was just something Tuesday night I observed. I was like, I really started to wonder two things, you know, something you struck. One, is Trump going to have a similar drag that Obama did on, you know, local races where the Republicans made massive gains in the 8 years that Obama was in office locally because of how polarizing he was. But the Democrats now, on the flip side of being out of power, are focusing more locally and maybe doing a better job there. But there's something to be said of what you touched on of, if we nationalize every local race, how disempowering that is to the citizens there. And then the arguments that they're having, they're not being represented anymore, because then whoever wins that primary fight is some sort of cipher for some nationalistic argument that had nothing to do with that local district. And therefore, to your point, then the final election becomes, again, just a repeat of whatever national politics are going on. There's something really actually horrible about that dynamic, if you believe in kind of power being resting with local authority more, you know, regardless of party affiliation. If you want local citizens to be empowered, this isn't a good dynamic. And it's something, I think we saw the flip side when Obama was president, and now the Republicans are seeing a bit of it. I think the Republicans seem to be more destructive in local races. The Democrats were just flat out losing them. But yeah, it's pretty depressing.
Yeah, the Democrats let their infrastructure crumble a little bit at the local level and the state level outside of the states where they just completely predominate, like, you know, New Jersey and cities like Philadelphia and Cleveland, Detroit, places like that. In places where it's more competitive, they've been so focused on the presidency because, well, they had it, and they're great centralizers, that they let some of the things slide in places where they should be more competitive. You know, we were talking earlier about the mayor's race in St. Petersburg, and I just happened a couple of years ago to write a story about Rick Baker, who was the candidate this time around. And at the time I was writing about him, was the mayor. And, you know, so he's the mayor of this not huge city in Florida, but a substantial city. And when he's running for election, people are asking about, you know, what do you think about abortion? What do you think about the war in Iraq and things like that? And I'm sure he had good, you know, conventional conservative opinions on all that stuff. But my God, the man is running for mayor of St. Petersburg. It's not like he's going to suddenly be commanding a platoon in Afghanistan, or that he's going to be, you know, the vote that decides Roe v. Wade or something like that. So you end up getting, you know, this demand for absolute ideological conformity and making every contest a contest about the things that the national and larger scale races are about. And I don't think that's really healthy for society. And I don't think it's healthy for political culture particularly, because sometimes, you know, there are races that you need to be fought about a smaller number of issues. Sometimes you really are going to have a race about, well, what do we do about school funding in the state of Texas? Or what do we do about the highways in Arizona? Or what do we do about rebuilding in New Orleans after Katrina? And if you have to make every election also a fight about abortion, Afghanistan, Iraq, affirmative action, the Supreme Court, and everything else that there is under the sun, then you end up bundling everything into choice A, choice B,
in a way that keeps that prevents real deliberation from the specific and particular issues from taking place in the way that it should.
Yeah, and you know, and actually, to tie into this and probably to wrap up soon, but I saw you wrote recently an article a little bit going after Dan Rather about our divisions in the world, and I'm wondering what do you. Yeah, what connecting to this, you know, nationalizing of everything and the polarizing of everything in society, you know, you kind of hinted to that, like what Dan Rather should really consider his role in this kind of division and how people have lost trust in the media. You know, how would you frame his role in that debate and how it's played into this, you know, nationalization of local races and having people kind of retreat?
Well, one of the things that keeps a democratic political culture healthy is intermediating institutions, right? So we've got institutions in society that we trust, whether it's the media, professional associations. I mentioned the American Bar Association, but the American Medical Association might stand in there. Churches, other sorts of civic groups, things like that. These are things that stand between the individual or the masses of individuals and the state, and they're part of what keeps a society healthy. But they have to have trust in order to operate. And people stop trusting Dan Rather not because right-wing media critics told them to, but because, you know, he falsified a story to try to throw a presidential election using forged documents to do it. You know, people didn't trust him because he didn't deserve to be trusted because he wasn't trustworthy. And to the extent that CBS never really acknowledged that, and they didn't, they said the story didn't meet our editorial standards, but they never really quite acknowledged it was a forgery and a political hit job, then they gave up a great deal of trustworthiness. And this just happened to happen at a moment in which online conservative activist journalism was really in its early stages being shaped. And that contributed mightily to the, you know, cynical, corrosive, adversarial culture that we have in conservative and left-wing as well, activist online journalism. Now, I mean, I want the press to be adversarial and skeptical, and I want people in politics to be tempered in their idealism and all the rest of it. But to the extent that we have it right now, which is, you know, cranked up to a state of near hysteria all the time, I think that's deeply unhealthy for us. And because we politicize and make partisan or quasi-partisan essentially everything now, then we no longer have institutions that both sides of the great political divide can kind of trust and agree on and say, well, okay, maybe you like this lawyer, maybe I don't like this lawyer, but the American Bar Association rates him a pretty good candidate for the bench. So if they say that about someone we don't like, well, it's the American Bar Association. What do you expect? They're a bunch of left-wing wackos. And if it's the other way around, then you'll hear the other sort of thing from the left. At some point, we have to have some shared public democratic space.
All right. So on that high note.
On that high note.
Yeah. All right. So Kevin, appreciate you being on. Always enjoy your perspective. And you know,
I'm always appreciative of how light he always goes on Trump. He really lets it go.
Yeah.
Really pulls back.
Yeah, he just kinda, you know, pulls the punches and, you know, doesn't
pulls the punches. Yeah. this is why I get invited on Fox News so much.
Yes. Well,
yeah, you're probably in their zone, huh?
Right there. Used to do it a lot. Not so much anymore.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've got the terms that you need to be in order to get those Fox interviews, but you know, whatever else that's for another show. You know, which,
that's for another show.
Yeah. All right. So, Kevin, thanks again for being on. Really appreciate it. And
well, thank you all for having me.
Yeah, I'd like to have you back again at some point. You know, maybe after the 2018 slaughter or something like that, or whatever. We'll see.
Well, let's hope it's not one, but we'll see.
Yeah. Okay. All right, Kevin Williamson from National Review. Everyone, thank you for that. And so that's going to wrap up the first show with Amy Otto as the co-host here. How about that?
Ah, I made it.
It was fun. It was good.
Excellent.
You know, yeah, it was great. I mean, Kevin's a great guest, and so, at the end of the day, there's the Republican Party has a lot to be worried about. I mean, you know, they're just
They don't deliver, and
that's the worst part. You know, you could sit there and talk about, you know, the GOP blowout in 2010, where they took back the House and they won all these other races in 2009 and everything else, and but they got Obamacare through, Democrats. You know,
that's the thing. If you know you're going to get slaughtered in 18 and you're Paul Ryan in the House, just lean into it and do everything you ever wanted and then walk away and feel good.
Exactly. You know? I mean, if you,
that's the stuff, the guts that bugs me. I'm like,
you're right. I mean, if you're going to lose, go down in a blaze of glory instead of whimpering out where you're not going to get anything done and still lose anyway.
Because it won't be about policy. Like, we all can pretend, you know, Obamacare didn't get repealed, but I'm sure half the people voting thought it did. You know, it's like, it doesn't matter. So I'm like, just go do what you needed to do and, you know, face the music. But that's what bothers me about the Republican Party, is they're never willing to quite step up when it comes to it.
Well, no, I mean, you know, and again, everybody's like, yeah, but look at the damage that happened with Obamacare from doing it. It's like, it doesn't matter. They still did it. I mean, yeah, after that, President Obama didn't have one signature, didn't have anything that of, you know, lasting value to add to his resume.
That's fine. So pick the one thing you choose to do and get it done. You know, that's the thing.
That's it.
What matters to them. Do something that expands freedom for Americans for once, as opposed to, I don't know, you know. But that's the thing. They don't seem to have a uniting principle that I can discern that's meaningful. They have too many factions that...
there's no leader that can sit there and get them to do everything, you know, to get them to come together for one thing. And that is where the biggest weakness is with Donald Trump, is that he can't rally those, especially in the Senate, those 2 to 3 people that he needs in order to get something, done. And, you know, and we've talked about this before. Sometimes politics is personal. And if you're going to spend your entire time doing nothing but bashing these guys all the time over the head, why then should they put their neck in, you know, stick their neck out for you? And then, you know, you're just going to bash them anyway. I mean, look what happened, how quickly Trump threw Ed Gillespie under the bus. You know, all he said, you know, it's like he's endorsing him, saying, hey, go out and vote for him, finds out he loses, and it's like, he didn't embrace me.
And everybody got upset about that. And I just looked at it and was like, you know, wow, Donald Trump is still Donald Trump. I just don't even like get amused by it.
No,
like,
but I mean, that's what I'm saying. That's like, what they should expect.
So, because that's his style, though, is like, if there's a loss, what he wants to do is disassociate from the loser quickly because his brand is winning. I was like, I know it's stupid, but I kind of understand the logic. I don't like it. I mean, I am not defending it, but I am saying there is a certain system to it. That's not some genius or four-dimensional chess. It's just a very simple behavior he engages in. If there's a loser thing and there's a stink of loserdom, he's going to try and cut it away from him like you would cut an arm off with gangrene.
Of course.
He can't necessarily disassociate it from himself. But he's going to try quickly, which is why he does it so fast. Because he's like, I'm going to dissociate from this brand of losing so I can keep saying I'm a winner. It's whether it's self-defense or it's whatever. It is brand management. I mean... it's admirable in a weird way. It's certainly not effective enough to deliver a majority anywhere. That's the problem.
Yeah, well, that's
and
the big
you're
problem.
You're starting to feel like the only reason he won was that Hillary was so darn bad, you know? And that's the scary part, is that there's a lot of false confidence here. It's like, well, if we could win with Trump, we must be like geniuses, because that, you know, my gosh, that seemed impossible.
Yeah.
I really think that all everyone underestimated was how bad Hillary was.
Yeah, well, that, you know,
it's
funny.
And that won't happen again. The Democrats won't make the same mistake twice.
No, they won't. I mean, not that they're going to have a great candidate, but they won't necessarily. They're certainly not going to have somebody as bad as Hillary. I mean, she was just awful. And so, and going back to Trump, I mean, I understand it's part of his brand. But the thing is, again, it comes back to the point where he doesn't have the ability. Or I should say, you know, he just doesn't, there's something there that he doesn't have in order, like you said, to rally people around him, to get something done. And people can't rely on him because, you know, it's like if they do something, he may just turn around a day later and say, well, I hate that part of the bill. I think it sucks. You know, and all of a sudden, you know, Republicans are left like, oh, my God, now what do? We got to scramble to do something different. So.
No, well, it's frustrating. It's like if he was your manager and every day, like there was like, oh, God, what's he going to think about today? I mean, you can imagine trying to work for him like, oh, wait, now he's talked to that person and he's on a completely different bent.
Yes.
Fantastic. Now I've got to undo that thinking.
Exactly.
I mean, that's what it's kind of like. Everybody's worked for a person like this, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know,
I know. I did.
Where you're like, yep, you know, it's just dysfunction junction every week, because you're like, whatever person he last talked to is what I have to undo.
Exactly.
And that's the problem, is, you know, because he has no internal barometer, it was like an advantage in an election because he could be anything to everybody. But when it comes to like, okay, we actually have to get stuff done, that's a weakness.
Absolutely. I agree. All right, everyone. That's going to do it for that was episode 70 of The Fifth Estate, mm-hmm. episode 1 for Amy Otto. We're really happy, and I think everything went well. And hopefully we'll have 70 more. And yeah, maybe at that point I'll leave and Amy will, I don't know. We'll see.
I can't believe you guys had 70 episodes already. That's amazing stuff.
Time flies. We did pretty good. And we had times where, you know, there were weeks off and stuff like that. Probably would have been more. And in fact, we had a lost episode that with Jeff Blair was on that it wound up just like getting lost completely. I felt terrible, and it was a really good episode. It was about linguistics, and it just was gone, and the whole thing was just disappeared. So it was terrible. That won't happen with this one, I promise. All right. So that's going to do it. We Amy and I will have to come up with, you know, the competing question. We got to kind of think of this, but when it comes to a lot of this stuff, we probably agree more than we disagree, like I did with Neil. So maybe we'll figure something else out.
Neil just likes being contrary. So yeah, we're going to have to find something contrary.
Yeah, we'll find something. I'm sure we will. All right. So, all right. For Amy Otto, I'm Jay Caruso. We will see you next time here on The Fifth Estate.